I now call the meeting back to order. Okay, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. At this time, I would like to ask Mr. Leland Trice to step forward.
Good evening. Please state your name and address for the record.
Leland Trice, 1003 Mount Hermon Road, Salisbury, Maryland, 21804.
Do you swear or affirm the testimony you're about to give us the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Thank you.
Mr. Trice, by whom are you employed and in what capacity?
I'm employed by the Trice Group, which is a firm I own.
And what is your professional and educational background?
I have a degree in economics. I'm a certified general appraiser in the states of Delaware, Maryland, and Virginia. I'm also a broker in the state of Maryland, real estate broker.
And how long have you been working in the appraisal industry?
Since 1985.
And does your work, I noticed you mentioned you live in Salisbury, but does your work and experience bring you to Sussex County?
Yes, I actually live in West Ocean City, Maryland. Offices in Salisbury, but we do business throughout all of Delaware and considerable amount in Sussex County.
And were you retained by AT&T Wireless to perform an analysis on the impact of the placement of the proposed monopole on the neighboring and surrounding property values?
I was.
All right. Well, to get started, can you generally describe the local area around the proposed site? And we've got some photos. These photos are all in Mr. Trice's report, which is at page or tab 6, but these are pretty big photos, so you may just want to look at the.
The site surrounding the Sea Pines Village is typical of a resort market. It's what I would characterize as a high density mixed use area. As you can see, we've labeled to the immediate east of the property, there's a series of power lines running along that road. The property on which the monopole is to be located is kind of a combination convenience store, gas pumps, fast food restaurant with a drive-through around the rear of that building. There is a retail furniture store at the southwest corner of Sea Pines. There is a hotel directly across the street to the south of Sea Pines. So it's not atypical for a resort market. There's a lot of uses kind of coexisting in a small space. That's just a photo I took on the site, standing kind of in the middle of the Sea Pines project, looking at an easterly view. Those are the power lines running along the road between Sea Pines and Sea Colony. And this photo was taken from standing in approximately the exact same place within Sea Pines, but looking to the west. So you can see the existing temporary monopole, which will be shifted to the north somewhat in the new location. That's a view from the corner of the Sea Pines property line. So there, I don't have the plat map with me, but there are buildings in Sea Pines that run along the southern edge of that building and also along the eastern edge of that building. That's a shot taken from the southwest corner of Sea Pines, showing the some of the commercial uses to that western location along Route 1. Again, that's another view kind of from the buildings along that southwestern part of the Sea Pines project. That's a photo taken along the eastern part of the property line, showing some of the Sea Pines units in proximity to the existing power lines along that road. That's another photo taken approximately from the corner there at Jefferson Bridge Road, again showing the row of power lines along that eastern border of the Sea Pines project. I didn't measure it, but I believe they would be. The easel is not engineered properly for this thing.
So that's all of it.
Yep.
How tall are those power lines there? 25 feet, 30 feet, 35 feet?
If the monopole's 80, I'd say they'd be 50-ish.
50? Couldn't tell by looking at them.
Okay. So, Mr. Trice, can you tell the board what type of analysis that you did?
We did two. We did one in 2011 for the prior hearing. At that point, the existing temporary monopole had not been on the site very long. So that influenced our decision on how to do an analysis to see if we could see if there was any impact from that pole. So there weren't enough sales within the Sea Pines project at that time. So we did what's called match pair analysis in our industry. And we looked at other pairings of sales within reasonably close proximity, and at that point we couldn't see any discernible difference. For an update for this hearing, since a lot more time had elapsed since 2010 when that pole was erected, we had enough data within Sea Pines to focus our analysis specifically in that community. So we looked at sales within Sea Pines. And the key for this analysis was to use what I'll call a control set. We needed to see how the sales in Sea Pines were behaving compared to the broader market. So that broader market we used is an area within the Sussex County Multiple List Service, generally referred to as east of the canal. So it's kind of this strip along the beach from Fenwick Island up through Bethany. So we looked at all of the sales and took statistics for all of the sales in that market and compared that to the statistics in the Sea Pines project. And again, we could not find any evidence that Sea Pines was behaving any differently than the broader market.
All right, I want to put up a chart which I believe is contained in your 2013 report, and I believe it also is just at tab 4 in the book.
So this is a chart. We plotted all these sales in a spreadsheet, and this is this chart. The red line to the top represents the average annual sale prices of all the sales in this east of canal region, and then the green line represents the average annual sales within the Sea Pines project itself. As you can see, they're very consistent in their behavior, a steady drop followed by a little rebound and now settling back down. So based on this information, as you can see, at the end of the study period in 2013, the broader market was actually down further than its original drop. Sea Pine sales actually are not. They actually, in that respect, have behaved a little better than the broader market.
And this annual average sales price data, that's from 2007 to 2013?
That is 2007 through the present.
Okay. And so, in your professional opinion, then, based on your 2011 report as well as your 2013 report, do you believe that the temporary tower has had a substantial effect on value?
We could not find any, no.
And generally speaking, why is that? Why do you think there wasn't an effect?
Well, as you can see from the photos we provided, in this high-density mixed-use area, there's a lot of influences surrounding this project already. So people, when they're making a purchase decision in Sea Pines and other areas in this resort market, there are many things that impact your decision, your view, your access, and a cell tower pole, a single monopole, really is an expected thing in today's world. As we showed, one side of this property is lined with power lines that have been there forever. People need power. They're an accepted part of the landscape. Apparently, people have been making purchase decisions in Sea Pines for many years in the presence of those lines and the other uses like the gas pumps and the convenience store, and we just didn't see any evidence that this one particular structure had a unique influence on property value.
And as part of your reports, did you also review professional literature on the impact of cell towers on property values?
We did. We looked out in our industry for other studies that had been done in similar situations. I did find one study since the last hearing that was a very recent study done by an MAI in North Carolina. His analysis, he had a community of unbuilt home sites in a subdivision next to two cell towers. And he compared that subdivision to a very similar project with unbuilt home sites next to no cell towers. And he couldn't find any statistical evidence that there was any difference in prices. And in his report, he also cited what I just said, that it's just becoming a typical utility that's expected to be present around real estate uses.
And so I have copies of a study from September 2013, August 2005, and May 2001. I did not make copies of these three studies and put them in your notebook. I just have one set that I would like to enter into the record, if that's okay with folks.
Yep, sure can.
Sir?
At this time, I don't have any more questions for Mr. Trison, so to the extent you all have questions.
Any members have any questions? No, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, there they are.
At this time, I would like to call our last witness, Mr. William McCain.
Good evening. Can you state your name and address for the record?
William R. McCain. Address is 5298 James Landing Road, Salisbury, Maryland.
Do you swear or affirm the testimony you're about to give is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Thank you.
Mr. McCain, by whom are you employed and in what capacity?
I'm employed by W. R. McCain & Associates, and I'm president.
And could you briefly describe your professional and educational background?
Yes, my educational background, I have an economics degree. I also have a master's of business administration degree, and I'm a certified general appraiser in the states of Delaware, Maryland, and Virginia. I also have the MAI designation with the Appraisal Institute. The MAI designation is stands for member of the Appraisal Institute, but it's the highest designation they offer, and the Appraisal Institute is the premier valuation professional organization in the United States.
And have you been appraising properties in Sussex County in the Bethany Beach, Fenwick area?
Yes, we have offices in Salisbury and Ocean View, Delaware. About 55% of our total business volume is in Delaware, and the majority of our Delaware work is in that eastern corridor of Sussex County. And I've been appraising for 27 years, and so I'm not sure how many appraisals I've done in Sussex during those years, but it certainly numbers in the thousands.
Okay, and can you maybe briefly describe, I'll say, is there a difference in appraising property in kind of a resort area like eastern Sussex versus more generally maybe western Sussex or other areas?
The resort area, all resort areas are somewhat unique, mainly because there is such a mixed use and high density often that makes up the real estate market, so it does make it somewhat unique.
And were you retained by AT&T Wireless to perform an analysis of the impact of the placement of the proposed monopole?
Yes, I was.
And can you tell the board what type of analysis you did?
I originally did an analysis back in 2011. I believe you have a, I believe they have a copy of that, correct?
And
10-9. That analysis focused on several, basically two aspects addressing the issue of the impact of cellular towers on residential real estate. The first methodology that was considered was basically a review of national research, articles that and research that has already been done on this subject. Several studies were researched. The last time I was here, actually, I had some detailed information on that. But just to sum that up, basically all those studies came to the conclusion that there was essentially no to very minimal, if any, impact that results from close proximity to a cellular tower. In fact, in the rare cases where they found some minimal negative impact, it was only attributable to the fact that a lot of negative publicity had been centered around the property. And once the time had gone by and the negative publicity had subsided, that actually the real estate values had increased on these properties. I also had looked at, just for additional information, studies on high voltage transmission lines, only because there's actually much more information involving that, and high voltage transmission lines are obviously larger and much more aesthetically invasive. But likewise, those studies had come to conclusions that seldom was there any impact from close proximity for residential real estate. So they had similar findings. In addition, in that 2011 study, you heard Mr. Trice talk about matched pairs. I had done a similar process looking at sales data in the area, pretty much looking at sales data from Lewis down into Ocean City. And what we had done was we had looked at located cellular towers, and we had looked at projects that were located in close proximity. And in your report there, I won't go through each one of those because the findings are similar, but most of these had, and I'll just give you a few examples, but Swan Cove, which is a residential subdivision outside of Selbyville, it has a tower located, and that tower, I believe, is it's 150-foot tower. And some of the properties are directly located and have direct views of that tower. So what we had done was we looked at sales in Swan Cove that have the direct views and ones that don't, and compared those. And basically the conclusion was there was no discernible difference in property values of the ones with the direct views of the tower versus the ones that did not. Likewise, we looked at Oyster Harbor. Oyster Harbor is actually in Ocean City, Maryland. It actually has a large tower. It's also a 150-foot tower as well. Likewise, in that subdivision, when you do match pairs, no discernible difference was discovered between the sales of properties in close proximity to the tower to ones that were not in close proximity to the tower. So there were several others. I did want to point out one of these other ones. And the reason I want to point out was the size of the tower, Sunset Island in Ocean City, a large, fairly high dollar project. It has directly across the canal adjacent to it, it has a 340-foot tower. It's the communication tower for Ocean City's emergency management department. So as you can imagine, a 340-foot tower, it's not a monopole tower. It's a lattice-style tower. And when you get that tall, you also get much wider as well. So it's a much more noticeable tower. But what we found was those units that are directly across the canal from it, as you move down the canal and get further from the tower, there was no difference in the sale prices, or no discernible difference in the sale prices of the units. They sold relatively the same prices, even though this was a 340-foot tower that was quite visible.
So there was a tower there before the development got there?
Yes. Yes.
The tower was there, then
yes.
The developer on it?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So those were the two primary methods that were done in that study, and the result was that the research, the objective empirical evidence, concluded that properties are not being penalized for close proximity to communication towers.
And did you also do a study in 2011 looking at rental rates?
Yes, also had looked at rental rates. In that study, it was found that comparing the rentals of Sea Pines Village, we had interviewed some of the rental agencies. Also, a lot of that information is actually online. And it appears a little over half of the units are rented. However, they vary everything from some are rented year-round, some are only winter rentals, and some are summer rentals. So there's a variety of rentals. But what was found was that the rental rates in Sea Pines Village were very comparable to other rental rates of similar units in the Bethany area. In fact, when you research the availability of units in Sea Pines around March or so, which is kind of your spring season prior to the summer, most of the rentals indicated there were no vacancies. There was no weeks available. They were filled up. So they have relatively good absorption of the rental market.
And those two reports appear at tabs 9 and 10 in the book that we provided. For this hearing, did you update your research and do further study?
Yes. For this hearing, I had done an update to the market study. The update.
And this appears at tab 8 of your binder.
I looked at sales. I think it was stated earlier, but this is somewhat unique in the fact that we know there is a temporary pole there that went up in the summer of 2010. Thus, I looked at the sales, tried to see what sales activity has occurred in Sea Pines. I know back in 2011, there was comments made that you couldn't sell units in Sea Pines once people saw or became aware of the tower. However, when you look at sales, I looked at the past 24 months, looked at two-bedroom condominium-slash-townhouse sales that were non-waterfront, non-water views, and looking in the MLS system for the Fenwick Bethany area and staying east of the canal, essentially there was 36 sales, and they ranged from $375,000 to $150,000. Of those, of the 10 highest-priced sales of that 36, Sea Pines Village accounted for 6 of the 10. In fact, the two highest-priced ones were Sea Pines Village units.
And this chart, in case your honors or members of the board want to look at it, is at tab 5. And that chart also appears in the full report, but I put it as a separate exhibit just in case you wanted to quickly reference it.
And there were two additional sales as well that were actually found in the tax records that were not in the MLS system. And likewise, they were somewhat in that same price range. One was $387,500, and one was $287,900.
And so is it fair to say, based on your professional opinion, that the proposed cell tower here will not have a substantial adverse effect on property values?
There was no data from the marketplace indicating that the cellular tower has had any negative impact on property values in Sea Pines. In fact, Sea Pines sales and rentals are mirroring the market, or actually appear to even be doing better than the market. And I think actually Mr. Trace's earlier graph, those two plotted lines, if you noticed on those, were almost identical with the Sea Pines Village actually doing a little bit better than the average market. But the data clearly indicates that.
At this time, I don't have any more questions for Mr. McCain's. The board has any questions?
No, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
And so at this point, in terms of the booklet that's in front of you, then you've got the usage statistics and chart front and the coverage gap exhibits, items 2 and 3, were discussed by Mr. Riffle. You've got the graph that Mr. Trice testified at tab 4. You've got the chart of the top 10 sales at tab 5. Mr. McCain just testified. Mr. Trice's 2013 and 2011 reports are at tabs 6 and 7. You have Mr. McCain's 3 reports at tabs 8, 9, and 10. And then you have the report of Dr. Foster at tab 11. We've also introduced, but not given you, copies of all the letters that were sent to the property owners when this whole process started. And we also provided those 3 other studies that Mr. Trice mentioned, demonstrating that even though it may seem counterintuitive to a large number of people in this room, at the end of the day, cell towers blend into the background and simply just don't have an effect on value. That's what the data shows, the hard data, the real data shows. I wanted to just answer briefly in my closing remarks, if I may, one of the questions that Mr. Sharp had asked, which was about standards. There had been an issue at the previous hearing about standards and what they and how they apply and what they apply. It actually has been developed in case law, and so I'm a lawyer and I pay attention to case law. Here's what the Third Circuit Court of Appeals has said. And this is a case, Cellular Telephone Company v. Zoning Board of Adjustment of Borough of Hohokus. That's what it says. 197 Fed 3rd, page 64, and the quote's on page 69. We conclude that there is a gap in personal wireless services when a remote user of those services is unable either to connect with the land-based national telephone network or to maintain a connection capable of supporting a reasonably uninterrupted communication. That statement then was elaborated upon in another case, American Cellular Network versus Upper Dublin Township, 203, Fed Sup Second 383, where the Federal District Court explained, although there surely can be no hard and fast percentage of failed calls to define a significant gap, the court concludes that a line of demarcation falling somewhere between 1.96% and 5 to 7% is a reasonable interpretation of the Federal Telecommunications Act. Unreliable service is service resulting in 10% failure. That is, one out of every 10 calls cannot go through or interrupted or dropped or have totally unintelligible sound quality. The 10% rate of unreliability is well beyond the line of demarcation defined by our earlier cases. Now, I quote that language to you because Mr. Sharp had asked, but you also heard the testimony, and in fact you have in your books, the call volume data for this tower. And it's kind of a unique situation. You've actually got hard and fast data. If that tower goes away, the percentage of calls that will go through will only be 20% or so. That's an 80% failure rate. That dwarfs the numbers that federal courts have said is significant. So I don't think there should be any question but that there is a need for this tower. The question was raised last time, and I wanted to make sure we really went out of our way to demonstrate that the need is there. We've looked at a lot of locations, as I said. And this is it. We're here tonight at this location, notwithstanding the fact that the neighbors don't want it, because we can't find another location. 25,000 calls went through on that cell tower July 4th. During the summer, 2 911 calls a day. And where would, I don't want to say you, but where should we go? Where would opponents have us go? Because no matter where we go, there's going to be opposition. I just want to read to you from the minutes of the Bethany Beach Town Council meeting that occurred in January of 2011, the week before the hearing that we held in February of 2011. So a motion was made to begin discussions with AT&T about use of the water tower in Bethany Beach. Ms. Cherry Dorfman, property owner, addressed the council. She was of the opinion that the tower should be erected where it is being proposed, outside of the corporate limits of town. She was against it being installed in the middle of town on the water tower. Mr. Tim Haley, property owner, explained that it would be in his backyard if the antenna were put on the water tower. He agreed with Ms. Dorfman, stating it is a better option to have it outside of town. So no matter where we go, people are going to complain. The question that, and by the way, Sussex County Council knew that. That's why they created fairly rigorous standards that we had to meet in order to get the special exception that we're asking you for. I think that we have met those standards. You've got appraisals from well-trained, well-qualified appraisers who have done very detailed studies. Six of the top 10 sales of two-bedroom condo units without a water view are in Sea Pines condominium. How could that be if this poll was the death knell of that community? And the answer is it isn't. These things really do fade into the background. We just lose track of them because we expect them to be there just like power lines and just like, you know, the Arby's or the gas station or the hotel or the furniture store. People just lose track. I know it doesn't seem perhaps obvious to those who live in the immediate area. I know they're here, and I don't doubt their good faith. But that's why AT&T went out and hired appraisers and did all the things we did. That's why we did the studies. We wouldn't be here tonight if there wasn't a huge demand for these services. And so, having presented all of this evidence, we would ask that you grant us the special exception. I'd like to reserve some time. I don't know what these folks are going to say. Last time that they came in front of you, they said a lot of things that weren't true, and we had to rebut them.
Please, excuse me, let him finish.
And so I would just ask for that opportunity again tonight.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, excuse me. Are there any persons here that are in opposition to this application? Keep your hands up, please.
What about in favor?
You're in opposition? Okay. You keep your hands down. Is there anyone here in favor of this application? One, two. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, what was the number against?
I got roughly 42. Okay, to all those that are in opposition, do we have a spokesman for the group? If not, all the... Okay, before they start?
Yeah, before he starts.
What, who for?
For the counselor.
Attorney, sir, could you come back up here a minute, please? Just a moment, please.
I have a question for you, Counselor. It seems like you've approached everything that 115.25, 194.1, which I'm sure you're well aware of as a county code. You've done that construction, for the construction, okay? You've given us testimony of everything that is related to that as far as, you know, the safety, et cetera, et cetera. Now, I just want a statement from you, okay, and I'm sure you can do this. You're a lawyer. You respond to me, and this is what this board wants to know, and that's what I want to know. How will this special use exception will not substantially affect adversely the uses of the adjacent and neighboring properties? Just give me a statement.
I appreciate the question. I appreciate your faith in my ability to answer it. As I said at the outset, the statute focuses on use. And I would submit to this board that, again, you're in a unique position because we put up a temporary tower 3 years ago. And I'm not aware, and no one has put forth evidence, that any use of the neighboring property has been adversely affected at all. People are still buying and selling units there. They're still going there. They're still renting properties. They're still enjoying their property, whether the tower is there or not. In fact, they might actually be enjoying it more because they've got better cell phone communications. So there's been no effect on the actual use of the property that has been demonstrated at all, nor do I think there can be. There was a case once in Sussex County where somebody was going to put up a monopole, and it was found that it would actually create a traffic hazard based on where it was going to be located, and that was deemed a substantial adverse effect. That's not the case here. In fact, some of the folks at the last hearing complained that, oh, gee, if this tower fell over, it might fall on one of the buildings. I couldn't rule that out. Mathematically, it was within 100 feet, the one building. So guess what? We actually moved, we redesigned the site slightly, and we've moved the pole back further. So there's no demonstration, nor can I conceive of any adverse effect on the actual use of the property. Now, I mentioned value is not part of what the statute says, but right, it's been addressed and by this board in the past, and so we've come forward, I think, also with two excellent appraisers who did very thorough analysis looking at all the market data, and what did they find? They found that just as real estate prices in general in the Fenwick to Bethany Beach or Bethany Beach to Fenwick corridor have performed, so have the units at Sea Pines. And that is from 2007 to 2013. So before the temporary pole was put up, they were moving in unison. After the pole was put up, they were moving in unison. So if there was going to be a substantial, and substantial, by the way, has to mean something more than just de minimis. I mean, substantial is real, meaningful, impactful. If there was going to be a substantial adverse effect on value, putting aside the fact the statute doesn't say value, you would not expect to see that at all. You would expect to see that Sea Pines would be behaving differently than the marketplace. But that's not what the data shows. The data shows it's performing as good or in some cases better. The data shows that 6 out of 10 of the highest sales of two-bedroom condo units occurred at Sea Pines. That's pretty good. And so I would submit, just as our appraisers did, that there's just no substantial adverse effect.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, sir. Okay, again, do we have a spokesman for the group?
Mr. Chairman, are we going to be hearing the folks who were in support or the folks who are in opposition first? What's your...
I get the ones, I guess, in support then.
Okay. I believe there were two.
Two.
Did either of you wish to speak, or... If you do, come on up.
Let's get the big crowd out.
Good evening. Can you state your name and address for the record?
Brian Pepper, 30735 Molly B. Road, Lewis, Delaware.
Do you swear or affirm the testimony you're about to give is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Thank you.
Good evening, sir.
I'm the general manager of Pep Up Inc. We run 75 hazardous material trucks up and down Sussex County year-round, and we are in favor of anything we can do to make sure that we have good GPS and cell phone coverage. Our truck drivers report a lot of accidents and need constant communications with 911. Thank you.
All right, sir. Anyone else? Okay. Now we'll come to the opposition. Those that would like to speak, would you please come forward to be sworn in?
Should we come as a group?
Yes.
Yeah, what we'll do is we'll have you introduce yourselves, and then we'll have a group swearing in, and then if there's a representative, we can, and we may just take a handful at a time here because it looks like there's...
If I may, Mr. Sharp, I'm going to speak first for C-Pines, but I'm not the exclusive speaker, so just if that's helpful in any way.
That would be fine. I guess before we get started, I know there's a lot of you here. I'm sure you all want to have an opportunity to speak, and we'd like to give that to you. If there is, we do want to avoid having redundant testimony. So even if you just come up and say, I agree with what so-and-so said, that's fine. But we'd encourage you to be as efficient as possible so we're not here all night.
And we also have several experts.
And that's fine, too. We'll take their testimony as well. I guess Mr. Girk, is it?
Yes.
How many do we have standing here that are going to testify?
Might I suggest we do a group, the experts and this first batch of people, or do you want everyone to do it at the same
time? Why don't we do that? Mr. Chairman, is that okay with you?
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask him to do. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
It'll be fine.
If we could do that, that'd be the best, I think.
Not experts.
All right, I'll start with you, sir. Can you state your name and address for the record?
Lou Kilmer, 974 Tortoise Street, Bethany Beach, Delaware.
Okay.
Dave Girk, unit number 14, Sea Pines Village.
Okay.
Jeremy Rains, 13420 Cleveland Drive, Rockville, Maryland.
Okay. Let the lady...
Oh, I'm sorry.
Vicki York, 50 West Avenue, Ocean View, Delaware.
Randall Handy, 4751 Briarhook Road, Seaford, Delaware.
Okay. If you all could just hang around here because we do have to get you sworn in, we're going to...
Greg Miller from Unit 9 at Sea Pines Village.
Thank you.
Greg Cox, Unit 4, Sea Pines Village.
Thank you.
John Hefferly.
Come on, we can catch you on the mic.
John Hefferly, 36870 Janigan Drive, Frankfort, Delaware.
Thank you. Can you speak up so we can catch on here?
Laura Marriott, 119 First Street, Bethany Beach.
Thank you. Okay, now everybody who we just got your name from, if you could come up here. Saves me from having to do it 10 times. Do you each swear or affirm the testimony you're about to give is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
For the record, all the ones we've just named have been sworn in. And Mr. Girk, I'll let you have the podium first.
Thank you.
My apologies, sorry. We had some exhibits we were gathering there. My name, as you heard swearing in, is Dave Girk. I'm owner of Sea Pines Unit 14. As I mentioned, we have a large number of folks to speak, but I volunteered and was asked to begin to introduce some of our documentation and help some of our witnesses through. My background, I'm a mechanical engineer. I'm also a professor at GW Law Engineering School, and I do also have a law degree. And I live on Laguna Drive, which you'll hear more about later. And as I said, because this application affects our whole community and, in fact, would actually kill our community, you'll be hearing from many members of this community. To address Mr. Workman's question, starting off with respect to the Supreme Court, as Mr. Sharp identified, the Supreme Court vacated the previous decision, your unanimous 5-0 decision, on a legal technicality. The word substantially was omitted in the written opinion by Mr. Sharp's predecessor. They didn't look at any of the evidence, and they said they couldn't. They just kicked it back and said, you have an opportunity to apply again. And Mr. Fortson had his comments on that, and I wanted to give our comments with respect to that. You all remember from last time that the previous evidence presented was compelling, real, truthful, and irrefutable. It's fully supported, in fact, and required you under the code to reject that application. But we again want to remind you what's critical here is to remember that the applicant has the burden to prove each and every requirement of this code. If the applicant does not prove with certainty that which they are required, as you know, you must reject the application. But you need not to fear. The facts and evidence in this case are overwhelming, and your decision to once again deny this ill-advised and deficient application is a clear one to make on the facts, just the facts. So I'm going to again recap because it's been a while since we touched on these. You know these better than anyone, but I just want to be clear that the requirements of special use exception is that it will not substantially affect adversely the uses of adjacent and neighboring property. Use, obviously, if you rent your property, Sea Pines Village is a big rental community. Many people rent. Mr. Fortson indicated he felt it just meant use. Obviously, if you're going to be injured in your property or using it, that's a substantial adverse effect on use. But moving to Section 115.194.2, the two things that must be proven by the applicant, again, is to show that existing structures within a two-mile radius of the proposed location are not available for co-location and to substantiate the need for such tower at the proposed location. So jumping into those, we will be proving tonight that there are antennas on a number of towers already within sufficient proximity and within sufficient height to provide coverage in the area of purported gap. Also, with respect to the assertion, I know Mr. Sharp asked Mr. Fortson about the licensing requirement, and in my opinion, he didn't really answer your question. He pointed to some case law about what gap meant and gave some definition about gap, but Mr. Sharp asked about your licensing requirement, because that's really what AT&T is saying, is that they're not going to be able to fulfill their license. Well, it's a fact that there is no requirement that they're not fulfilling. We will talk a little bit more about the particulars about that in 47 CFR. And additionally, we've consulted with John Gabrith, an FCC engineer. Most licensing requirements and most licenses for providers are two years in length till you have to fulfill your requirements. And each license is different, so Mr. Fortson could tell you what's in his license. Obviously, I can't tell what's in that license, but I wanted to address that. Also, we've heard a lot about this large volume of calls that are at this location. As you may or may not know, Bethany Beach has a population of 1,000 people. When you think about places serviced by cell service, New York, Chicago, Washington, D.C., a thousand's a drop in the bucket. So we'll get into more detail with the experts about that sort of thing. Interestingly, we're going to show you tonight also that that gap can easily be filled. And in fact, AT&T already has that infrastructure because they have a facility only 0.38 miles from the proposed site of their location. And that wasn't identified on any of the documentation, at least they provided in the application that we saw. So we'll talk about that. That's 670 yards. So if you're a little stronger than Tiger Woods, that's how far you are from where they have a facility that they already are operating, allegedly, but they're not taking that into account in this application. And even worse, we're going to show how we feel that AT&T either clearly overlooked this or perhaps even worse, didn't want to submit this to the board. And further, it's not a gap in coverage issue here. What's really more likely happening is an interference issue. So the need is not more coverage. It's that they need to figure out how to rid the interference. And we'll talk about ways that you can get rid of interference in a minute. Again, remember the code requires that the applicant show that existing structures within 2 miles, a 2 mile radius of the proposed location are not available for co-location. Interestingly, at the last hearing, and even in the application materials themselves, the applicant has actually admitted they can't meet this requirement. They admit there are multiple locations available to them within a 2 mile radius for co-location. They just refuse to use them, or they say it's not going to work for our purposes. So by very definition, they have admitted, and what I say by admitted, I'm going to pull out testimony from the previous case, and I'm going to read you. It's a very short blurb, but Ms. Scott, and this is on page 28 of, it's the transcript from the last hearing. Ms. Scott says, and this is in taking testimony of Mr. Rafael, who I believe is here today and has already spoken to you. What about one of the things that Mr. Zolna and I talked about was a possibility of co-locating? In other words, putting antennas on existing structures. And Mr. Zolna indicated that he could not find anything suitable within the search ring. Is that something we can further discuss in terms of your efforts? Mr. Rafael, yes, there were some existing structures that would be suitable. And when I say they would be suitable, they're suitable from a real estate perspective. I believe he used that term this evening as well. I continue. Meaning the landlord was willing to work with AT&T if it was a site that could fulfill AT&T's radio frequency needs. There were three existing lattice towers that are in the 2 mile radius. Additionally, there was one water tank that's in the area. All three of those, from a real estate perspective, were available for AT&T. So I know Mr. Fortson encouraged us to just focus on the requirements, and I purport to you that right there, AT&T has not met the requirements. And again, in the application, the new application, Mr. Abreu's letter, I might be mispronouncing his name, I apologize, but forms the basis of the application, admits that there are available sites for co-location. While the county code only requires that there be an available co-location to require rejection of the application, AT&T has tried to twist that standard here and to say that to require that it be perfect for them or fit their needs. That's not the standard. The standard is simply, are they available within a 2 mile radius? If they are, it's the provider's job to make it work, and the code requires rejection of any such special use application. And we will discuss some coincidences about that 2 mile radius, is that actually is a distance that the handset can reach to an antenna. So if you have an antenna within that 2 mile location in your code provisions, what that does is that gives some certainty that a provider or anyone on a cell phone could reach an antenna in that 2 mile radius. And so if you had a site, you should be able to communicate. Regardless, we'll demonstrate that multiple co-location sites admitted to be available easily serve the provider's needs if they were in fact a gap. Additionally, there was some talk of utility poles. Utility poles are mandated by federal law to be available to the applicant, and there are of significant height and run throughout the purported area of gap in coverage. In fact, they run down two areas of coverage, and we'll talk more about that tonight. They run down Highway 1, and they run down Pennsylvania Avenue. Either one, they basically sandwich between those two roads where the proposed site is. And there's an immense number of locations, of course, because you could pick any utility pole you want and place those antennas at the top of that. Finally, we're going to talk about that standard Mr. Rickard succinctly came to at the end there about will not substantially affect adversely the uses of adjacent and neighboring property. Among the things we're going to show, large reduction in property values here, reduction in the ability to rent. These are resort properties. Rental are something that many of the homeowners rely upon to pay their mortgage. They rent in the summer, and then in the winter they can use it, and there's no vacancy like March because they themselves are using it or they don't keep their rental companies going, but summertime is when they rent, and that's how they're able to have these properties. Without that rental income, they're not. Safety hazards. These aren't theoretical safety hazards. They're very real. Placing a monopole in a retention pond next to a gas station surrounded by homes is not only dangerous in a bad place, it's perhaps the worst possible place. The only thing that could make it worse is to put a lot of winds and hurricanes through it. You've just done that because we're two blocks from the ocean. Also, by sticking the monopole into the retention pod, you've increased the likelihood of flooding. And contrary to what AT&T has suggested, as we will discuss a little further, that will decrease the volume of the retention pond, which is something that is in violation of the DENREC stormwater, and they do have to prove that they've maintained the same volume of the retention pond. We already flood, so I can only imagine what we'll get. And finally, use and enjoyment. You know, there's something, your property, the code word use, again, use and enjoyment. These are resort properties. Views are an integral part of these properties and why people purchase these homes. And it's just not something that can be passed to the side. They're two blocks from the beach. Even just a perception of health or safety risk undermines value and rental ability, let alone when there's real safety risks here due to convergence of many factors of danger. One or two more things before I get to the exhibits, and then we'll bring up the witnesses. I apologize. I'm moving as quickly as I can. Mr. Fortson mentioned 70% of calls for 911 are made on cell phones. That's a very compelling and interesting fact, and I think he made that point to suggest that without this cell tower, 911 calls will be lost. In fact, if you do a little research, any 911 call, any provider is obligated to pick up that call. So if there's no AT&T or no Verizon service or no Sprint in one of those in an area, the other provider must pick that call and forward it, which makes sense because you don't want a 911 call going missed because of lack of service. With that, I'm going to leave you with, stop my intro spiel. with a comment, and this is Judge Graves in the Superior Court, and in the case you previously decided, and I'm just going to quote a little paragraph here, and he says, homeowners are, of course, also competent to testify on the matter of their property values, and the board may give proper deference to their testimony. The board can accept testimony of this nature because an owner of real property, by reason of that ownership, is presumed to have special knowledge as to its value and therefore competent to testify in that respect. He then continues on and says, in response to neighboring homeowners' testimony detailing their quality of life and safety concerns, there is no evidence that AT&T did or frankly could rebut this evidence. Although few generalized expressions of concern with aesthetics cannot serve as substantial evidence on which the board could base its denial, in this case, the opposition consisted of many nearby property owners who testified to specific aesthetic, visual, and safety concerns that went unrebutted by AT&T, save for a general averment that the proposed tower would be built subject to national code requirements. Under the unique circumstances presented, the homeowner's testimony as to quality of life issues may serve as evidence of a negative effect on neighboring property use. The board may properly rely upon such evidence in denying an application for a special use exception. If you recall, we heard once again this evening that everything's built within code. So, of course, everything will be fine and no one will be harmed. But At that point, I'm now going to introduce, I have a packet for everybody. I'm sure everyone's excited to add to their big pile. and we have one for Mr. Sharp for the record.
If we have enough.
Okay.
You need one for them. Give one back to Lawrence for the record time. You want to keep that for the records, right?
What I'll do is I'll use this for the hearing, then I'll give it to Ms. Norwood so she can put it into the record after the hearing.
Your question?
Sure, please.
You said coverage and interference.
Sure.
What are you saying? He's saying you need they need the coverage for that tower to work. You're saying...
Sure. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off. Go ahead.
No, you're saying interference. What do you? What's the difference here?
I'm going to defer a further answer on this to... we have Dr. Raines who's going to speak on these issues, okay. But I will tell you I do know the answer, so we'll let him clarify. The difference is coverage is how far can you cover, like coverage on a map. Interference means it's not that you can't get there. Something else is blocking you, like an interference in football or I don't know what analogy. So those are two different issues. It doesn't matter where, you know, moving cell tower locations only can do coverage to some extent. And if I misstate something, I'll let Dr. Innes correct it. But interference, if you have an interference problem, you may have perfect coverage, but the interference is stopping you from that signal getting there. But I'm going to defer the rest to Dr. Raines.
Okay.
That's my understanding of it, at least. So I'm just going to walk through these exhibits to not take up any more of your time. A few of these will come up later, but rather than spend too much time on any of these, I'm hoping to walk through with them. The first exhibit, if you could put the big one up, please. That one is Sea Pines Village. I think you've probably seen some pictures of it. The one thing I do want to note is, yes, currently there. This is an old picture, but currently the property to the north is trees, and there's not a resident, or there's a dilapidated residence up front, but it's not developed. But I heard Mr. Fortson say it's not for development. Well, that's not true, and I'll show you in a later exhibit that there's a 7-condo townhome site already been before the county and is slated to come in there. So there's going to be houses or housing there. Exhibit 2, we have, and if you bear with me slowly, we heard a lot of talk about monopoles. They're just part of the scenery. So this was our scenery before the temporary tower and before a bigger monopole would come. And, you know, someone buying this house, it's just part of the scenery. And that actually was drawn by an architect with using the best off of the scale not to scale drawings that were submitted, and estimating what a 100-foot tower with 3 or 4 carriers would look like. And that's the drive up when I drive home every day at Sea Pines there when I come and stay. That's what I look at. And obviously,
is that based on the location of the current tower or where the proposed new tower would go?
The new tower would probably, if I step up there, I'll show you where it is. It's fine. Slightly moved, frankly, right there. So it's just shifted a few feet that way. So that's the same view.
Is it also shifted further away?
A few feet, but from that perspective, it gives the same visual impression.
How the current tower, how close is it to the property line? I'm sorry, I don't remember.
The current temporary tower or the proposed?
Current temporary.
It's in the center, it's 71 feet.
Okay.
So you moved that far.
And they're talking about 107 or 108?
103, I think. 107 on the other direction.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Yep. This is our pool. This is where, obviously, renters are going to spend time. This is where we enjoy spending our time. And that, obviously, you know, monopoles and cell towers are just part of the scenery. You're supposed to expect that. There's all this bad stuff. So that's what we're looking at. So that gives you an idea of what we're up against here.
Would that be that many antennas on there?
There's four arrays there. Their plans are for three arrays, but we heard in testimony in the previous case that they had three other providers that were going to come, in which case there would be four arrays. Exhibit 3, we talked about the retention pond. As you can see, this is where that temporary tower is. There's a trailer, and you can see the water seeping up out of the retention pond. The retention pond is regularly full. So 3 and 4, 4 shows water leaking out of the retention pond up onto the parking lot. And this is not an infrequent occurrence. This is a frequent occurrence. That retention pond is very full very frequently. And in our observation, it's been higher since the temporary tower and trailer structure went in there. Now, it could be just a rainy season for the last couple of years, but obviously anytime you add stuff into a pond, the volume goes up. Exhibit 5, this is our backside by the pool area. So what you're looking at is the left corner of the photo would be where the retention pond is, the left side. And so this is the water comes out of the retention pond into our yard on a heavy rain, and this is a recent, fairly recent storm. As many of you know, in Bethany Beach, it's not infrequent to have a lot of flooding. There's a better picture. I apologize.
This is from the rain this year, though.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a little bit unnormal for rain like we have in here. What we've been getting. So that, you have that.
That's true. That's true there, but that's probably a pretty big storm. But the standards per DENREC is you had a plan for a 100-year flood, or a 100-year storm, I'm sorry. And currently the retention pond's only set up for a 10-year storm. So they're going to have to figure something out, and there's not a lot of space there if they're going to stick a monopole and some other things in there. As was mentioned, Mr. Lank, I think, read the letter from DENREC, and I think whoever testified on behalf of AT&T here about that said they didn't need to do anything. Now, we spoke with the program manager, and that's not the story we heard, that they were going to have to submit calculations and figure out a new way to meet the because they're altering the volume in the pond, how to do that, and as is stated in this letter here, that that hasn't been done yet, and she hasn't heard of any plans to do that. So obviously the pond is going to be an issue and may substantially adversely affect us if the design causes us flooding, whatever else can happen with a bad design of that regard. Exhibit 7, as was mentioned, the property to the north that was slated to be is slated to be 7 townhomes. Mr. Fortune mentioned it's not for development. This is the document that shows some of the development plans and some of the occurrences before Sussex County on that property. So as far as the latest action was, that property is to be developed with 7 townhomes. So to the extent they've been nice and moved it a few feet from us, I still feel we're in the zone of danger. 125% is a typical vertical fall zone, safety zone for wind turbines, sometimes 100 to 125, but 7 feet, I don't know about you, 100-foot monopole falling, I don't feel too comfortable if all I got is 7 feet. Exhibit 8 is going to get addressed later, but it's an architect from Delaware, licensed in Delaware, reviewed the site and had significant concerns about a number of different aspects, including footings being unstable, accelerated deterioration because of the pond being continually wet, as well as the fact that structures like this can fall in unexpected ways, particularly in salty and windy beach environments. Exhibit 9 is another letter from a person with a master's degree in design, build, construction management from Auburn, who has worked for AECOM and AHDR, two international known architecture firms, and we'll address that later. Some more details about her having concerns with the structure and those aspects. Exhibit 10, Mr. Cox will be addressing later. Exhibit 11 is a document from Brian Crowley. We heard some testimony about rentals that no rental values were bothered or they checked the rental stats. Mr. Crowley operates a lot of rental in the Bethany Beach area, and it's very short, so I'm going to read it briefly if you bear with me. I'm writing to request that you vote against the special use exception AT&T has applied for at the BP gas station Arby's near the corner of Route 1 and Jefferson Bridge. This tower will have a substantially adverse effect on rentals in the area and in particular Sea Pines Village. When my agency shows the units at Sea Pines to potential renters, they are concerned about the safety hazards and nuisance factors like bright lights and noise that will be part of this tower. They ask to see other rentals rather than subject their families to potential dangers and unsightly tower hovering over their tranquil vacation rental. Each unit that I cannot rent results in approximately a $13,000 per year loss to the property owner. These owners count on rentals to help pay their mortgages. This tower is bad for Bethany Beach tourism overall. People come here for the quiet resort. They will consider going elsewhere where they are not subjected to potential dangers and views of 100-foot towers that belong out in fields away from densely populated vacation rentals. The next exhibit is a packet of four letters from actual renters at Sea Pines Village. We asked to get their input, whether they thought, would they come back, how would the tower affect their decision, and these are some examples. We don't want to clutter up your file of actual renters who said that they would be inclined not to come back, and I'll leave that for you to consider later. Exhibit 13, Laura Marriott will be addressing. It's a letter from the Bethany Beach Landowners Association, 900 member households, and their feelings in opposition and concerns with the tower. Exhibit 14 is also a letter from Grace Ventura. Her parents have been owners since 1978, and they rely upon the rental income. They're both in nursing homes to cover their added expenses, and they have significant concerns with that amongst a number of other factors associated with the tower being nearby. Exhibit 15 is another letter by an owner, which will get addressed later. Exhibit 16 is my affidavit regarding harms from previous cases that remains true and continues. I want to verify everything in there yet again. Exhibit 17 is a letter from the town manager of South Bethany back in 2011 that AT&T hadn't even contacted them to try and put up towers or antennas on their tower. I know there's been some testimony about that, but at least as of 2011, South Bethany hadn't been fully investigated. Exhibit 18, as mentioned, we'll talk a little further. If I could ask you for one moment. As shown in Exhibit 18, the yellow dot indicates the location of an AT&T antenna on top of a utility pole along Highway 1. And it's right in front of Long and Foster. If you know that area, there's a Long and Foster. There's a McDonald's, a Dunkin' Donuts. It's right there. It's 0.38 miles as the crow flies, as I said, 670 yards. A good Phil Mickelson drive and a roll away. And clearly that site could provide what they're needed. And we'll discuss more about that as we get a little later. Exhibit 19 is a picture of that pole. And Exhibit 20, also the No, it's okay. Forget about it. I'm good. Exhibit 20 is the pole mount hardware to help that, and we'll get into that in more detail. 21 is, as you can read there, AT&T Mobility operates telecommunication antennas at this location. So that's their identification there on the structure there that I mentioned. Now, there was talk of placing antennas on utility poles. I know AT&T says that's not an option. It's mandated on by the federal law that these poles have to be available to telecommunication providers. Exhibit 22 shows you, this is Highway 1 looking into Bethany. You can see Colony in the distance, and that's a straight shot right there. You can see, at least in that picture, seven towers in intermittent sequence coming right into downtown Bethany, where this purported gap in coverage is, where someone could easily lop on the same kind of pole or same kind of pole mount antennas as you saw in the previous exhibits. But as you've heard, the testimony by AT&T, they've looked everywhere. It just can't seem to find any place but right next to our property. So exhibit 23.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, I hate to interrupt. I know normally we don't do it, but I think it could save us a little bit of time on rebuttal. That tower that you're talking about on the pole is not an AT&T tower.
Mr. Sharp, I'd prefer to present our case. We didn't interrupt.
Mr. Chairman, I mean, we don't have cross-examination that we're doing. So
this is highly.
I do know Mr. Forson's trying to clear something up that may save some time. So
I would object, Mr. Sharp, to this. I didn't. I had a lot of things I wanted to clarify when Mr. Forson was talking, and this isn't how board proceedings, I understand, operate, sir.
Mr. Chairman, if I may just briefly explain, I wouldn't do this except for the fact I think we're going to waste a lot of time talking about this antenna on top of the utility pole. And I understand that Mr. Girth believes it to be an AT&T facility. It is not. And so I don't want to waste a lot of time talking about something that doesn't work for AT&T.
Mr.
Mislabeled. The label has been removed because it's not an AT&T facility. It's actually T-Mobile. And so before we go really far down the road, I counted at least four exhibits that relate to that. I can wait and come back and say it, but I don't. It's just going to take a lot of time if he testifies about something that's not true.
The applicant had an opportunity, Mr. Chairman. I think that the opposition should have that same opportunity and respect. Thank you.
In respect to.
I meant no disrespect.
should present his case, Mr. Chairman. Yeah. I believe he should present his case. That's my opinion.
Should I proceed? Thank you, sir. Exhibit 23, this is a recent instance in Pennsylvania, Bethel, Pennsylvania, where an AT&T tower caught fire, and a 300-foot radius was maintained, evacuated for several hours. The fire department couldn't get in there to treat the fire, and they had to leave the 300-foot. I'm sorry.
What exhibit is that?
23. My apologies.
Okay. Thank you.
And we'll talk a little bit more about that later. And we will be succinct, I promise, Board. You will hear from us succinctly. Exhibit 24 is some examples of instances with cell tower. I want to point your attention to the first one, and that being the first picture there. As you can see, that's a monopole in wet soil tipping there. And that monopole, as there were concerns in the earlier exhibits by architectural Delaware architect, as well as design, build, construction, management person about the wet soil and the stability. Actually, a monopole is less stable than other structures that are, for example, utility poles that are strung together because it's just one point in the ground. And so the forces all act on that. Exhibit 25 is just to give you an idea of a worst-case scenario. I won't spend a lot of time. And with that, we're to Dr. Raines. And so if you will allow me to introduce Dr. Raines and point to answer some questions.
Sir, can I ask you one question? How much runoff
are you going to have from that tower? I mean, do you know how much runoff you're going to get to affect that pond? You're talking about runoff in your pictures and everything?
Sure. What you're asking is how much more will the tower fill the pond? Is that your question?
Yeah. I mean, how much?
In speaking with the, I don't know. I mean, it's a big structure. Yeah. But, you know, I think in speaking with Denrek would be the way to know that. But I think numbers like, I'm not going to purport to know. I'll just say it's going to increase.
Yeah, I mean, you're showing pictures of runoff and everything going to be that much more, you said. How much more?
I mean, I don't know. The burden's on them to show we're not going to be substantially adversely affected, and I will say that at least we've raised the issue that we think it's an issue for you.
Okay.
If that's a fair answer.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, Dr. Reed. All right. Why don't you come on this side? And to aid facilitate Dr. Rain's testimony, we're going to have a couple slides that we're going to discuss with Dr. Rains. Dr. Rains, could you please state your name and your background for us?
Yes, my name is Jeremy Rains. I have a PhD in electromagnetics from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. I have a master's degree in applied physics from Harvard University, and I have a bachelor's degree in electrical engineering from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and I'm a registered professional engineer in the state of Maryland. Professionally, my concentration has been on antennas and radio wave propagation all of my professional life. I professionally live and breathe those subjects. They're of great interest to me.
And what about your experience with respect to cellular systems and cell design?
I was first approached to design, specify, and predict the radio wave propagation associated with cellular base stations in the early 1980s, about 1983, I suspect, for a company called Charisma, one of the early cellular companies. They since have been absorbed. I don't know where they are now in the world of cellular. But I spent a lot of time calculating antenna patterns and predicting propagation paths. Since that time, I've been asked from time to time to specify and design or analyze cellular antennas. And most recently, and perhaps most interestingly, I've been asked to track down and identify sources of interference to cellular base stations. It turns out they're quite fragile. We take wireless communication perhaps for granted and that it is a robust and reliable facility and is comparable to a landline telephone. Gentlemen and Ms. Norwood, it's not. There are numerous sources of interference out there, and some of them would truly amaze you. They include garage door openers, baby monitors, devices called cell phone signal boosters, which are actually, for the most part, illegal, but you can buy them on the internet, and you can see them advertised on late-night television, and in fact, people buy them because they perceive they have poor wireless coverage, but when they turn on these cell phone boosters, they actually overwhelm base stations. They make things worse. So there's a lot of jamming out there. And Mr. Workman, I believe you asked, what's the difference between coverage and interference? Interference is basically jamming by these electronic devices that were unanticipated as participants in our world of electromagnetism. One of the major interferers that you should know about are cable television amplifiers. I've discovered them in the attics of homes. They were left there basically unused. The cable television was disconnected years ago, but they forgot to unplug the amplifier, and it sat there, and its oscillator radiated away, and it took out an entire key in the Florida Keys until it was tracked down. There are leaky cable television amplifiers strung all over town. You may see them, and you know, unless they're properly maintained, they will take out a base station. So this has been a frequent activity for me for the past few years, is tracking these down and identifying sources of interference. It's an ever-growing list. It's quite a fascinating subject for me professionally, and I think it's pertinent to what you're hearing here tonight and your decision-making process.
Thank you, Dr. Raines. We have one of your exhibits up there, and that is actually exhibit number...
Two, I believe.
Two. Two, yes, exhibit two. Could you explain to us what this exhibit illustrates?
Yes, this leads quite nicely into the rest of our discussion. The weak link in your wireless communication is your handset. It only has a very moderate, if not weak, transmitter. It's typically less than a watt. It's about 600 milliwatts or 0.6 watts, as shown in this photo. And the FCC requires that a usable signal for wireless communication, cellular communication, be at least 32 decibels above a microvolt per meter. That's how we measure those things, or 40 microvolts per meter. That's how we measure electric fields. But it's a number, and it's in the FCC regulations. You shall provide a field strength of at least that. Now, under ideal conditions, under line-of-sight conditions, where you have an unobstructed shot between your handset and the base station, that 600 milliwatts should carry for 6 miles and deliver that field strength. It seldom does that. And the reason is the variability and unpredictability of radio wave propagation. Now, we heard earlier from the applicant that they have precise computer models that can predict where there's a gap and where the signal goes and where it doesn't. I disagree with that claim. I think these computer models are pretty good initial guess, but they can't possibly be that accurate. And the reason is they're too coarse in their data. Now, the applicant's expert testified that his computer model has a data point concerning various obstacles and other characteristics every 25 meters. Well, keep in mind that a wavelength at these cellular frequencies is only about a foot. And to have real resolution of what that propagation path looks like and to be able to model it, you have to resolve that propagation path every fraction of a wavelength, not every 25 meters, but maybe every few inches. And there's no computer that I know of that can do that. And more importantly, there's no database that supplies that kind of data with that kind of precision. And to give you a practical example of how these computer models can break down, if a delivery truck is parked outside a store, well, that's many, many wavelengths long. That changes the propagation path. If someone goes outside and moves their metal trash can, that changes the propagation path. You can't possibly model those things with the kind of precision that was implied here. They're good guesses, but I think a good comparison as far as predicting these radio propagation paths and open space or in the presence of a terrain like this is pretty much similar to predicting the weather. Now, you're very familiar with what happens when a big storm is coming. A few days out, they say, well, our model predicts the storm might go this way, and our other model predicts the storm might go that way, and the other model might predict the storm goes this way, and in fact, you know, the storm might miss your coast entirely, or it might be more severe. It's the same sort of thing the same sort of precision, the same sort of accuracy that's involved in predicting these radio propagation paths. Well, that doesn't mean we should give up on wireless communication. It works a lot of the time, if not most of the time, and it certainly is desirable. How do we accommodate the lack of precision in these propagation programs? Well, it's been determined that our propagation models are good. They're in the ballpark. They're good to within order of magnitude. They're good to within 10 decibels, or in be a little more practical, any distance or position that might be predicted by one of these models is only good to within a factor of the square root of 10. So if someone says the tower has to be right here, well, it really doesn't have to be right here. There's a circle of uncertainty around it. That's equal to the square root of 10 of the distance of that tower from the anticipated service area. Now, don't take my word for that. I didn't invent that square root of 10 factor. I first heard it from a fellow named Phil Rice. Phil Rice was a chief scientist at the National Bureau of Standards, the Boulder, Colorado Radio Propagation Laboratory. There's a famous formula named after him and his coworker. It's the Longley-Rice formula. That's the basic formula that's the foundation of all these propagation programs. And he, in fact, in a discussion with me during testimony many years ago, said these programs are only good to within 10 dB. Now, he's not the only one. I had the privilege of working with a legendary radar engineer at Lockheed Martin. His name was Richard Ludwig, and he was famous for saying, you can get 10 dB of anything. And that was just his way of saying, we don't know what the signal strength is. He was talking about radar scattering at the time, but it's just as applicable to received radio strength. You can only know that to within 10 dB, or you can only predict it to within 10 dB. So there's the message I want to get across with this slide is that there's uncertainty in these prediction methods, and it's uncertain to within a factor of a square root of 10. And because of that, instead of 6 miles under ideal conditions, we divide by the square root of 10, and as a practical matter, your handset, you can really only count on it to go 2 miles.
So you're saying 2 miles, though, you can reliably, within 2 miles, you can expect if there's a base station 2 miles away that you should be able to communicate with it generally.
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah. So this is another exhibit we have here and in your packet on Rain's exhibit, and this is exhibit 18. There you go, Jerry.
Thank you. Well, I can look right at the slide right, as well as anyone else.
And if you want to talk to, I see the Pepper and Steiner property located. And as mentioned, there's that Long and Foster utility pole. And just to save any problems, there are utility poles running right up down that highway. So if you put one on the next utility pole or the one before, AT&T could still have a location there, correct, Dr. Rain?
Sure.
Okay, so what does this show, the blue circle and the black circle?
Well, the black circle and the map, in fact, was provided by the applicant in its application. And you can see within that black circle a number of towers and I see, yeah, right, thank you. And in fact, I visited the second floor of Mango Mike's down in downtown Bethany Beach, because that's where the applicant says they have a serious coverage gap. And I stood on the second floor there, and I looked out over the horizon, and I had a visual sight of no less than 6 communications towers or water towers. And, you know, all of those were a straight shot, and they're well within at least three of them are within 2 miles.
And so if they're within 2 miles and you can see them line of sight, then based on your previous slide and the power of the handset, you would expect you should be able to use it as a communication. So if AT&T placed their antennas on those sites, namely we're looking at the map within there, the Ready Call one listed, the Crown site, they already have a location. South Bethany, you would expect that that those distances are, since they're within the 2 mile radius, that blue circle around downtown Bethany, that you would be able to reach them.
That's in fact the blue circle was added by me. That's a 2 mile ring around Bethany Beach, and that's supposed to be the serious gap that the applicant claims to have. So within that blue circle, there are plenty of towers within clear shot, and I don't see any reason why with the a proper installation of a base station antenna, they can't cover Bethany Beach from one of those.
What exhibit is that?
13,
R13. All right. Well, this is a closely related exhibit, and again, the applicant asserts that according to their studies, the proposed tower has to be right there on that spot. They've moved it around a few feet within the lot. They said it has to be there. There's no other place. Well, once again, I would remind you that these radio propagation predictions have a fudge factor or a compensation factor, adjustment factor of the square root of 10. And so if you measure the distance from the proposed monopole site to the center of Bethany Beach, I think that, if memory serves correctly, that turns out to be 0.29 miles. If you multiply that by the square root of 10, you get 0.91 miles, and this inner circle is a radius of 0.91 miles. And what that means is, due to the uncertainty in the predictability of radio propagation paths, their proposed tower could be anywhere inside that little blue circle, and they'd probably predict the same coverage of Bethany Beach. It's just that uncertain when you use these computer programs to try and predict what's going on.
Would it be fair to say, Dr. Raines, that then they do not need that particular tower at that location?
Yes, that would be my professional opinion. There are plenty of other locations within that little blue circle. In particular, a lot of utility poles, and we know that base station antennas can be mounted on utility poles. They've been demonstrated in practice.
Sir, on the utility poles, going back to these utility poles, they stated you got to have a generator and everything else on this thing. Where are you going to put all this generator and their works on a utility pole? You got to have it somewhere. So where are you going to put this, on the highway?
Well, we have a picture of that, Mr. Workman. I think it might be the next slide. Let's take a look, Dana. Yes. This is the base station on top of a utility pole outside of Long and Foster. And down at the base is all their radio electronics, all the little transmitters, receivers, combiners, duplexers, all that hardware that goes behind the antennas in there. And I don't know how visible it is, but at coming out of the bottom of that little miniaturized radio shack are some power cables. And they're in the ground, and they go somewhere. Get their power. I don't know exactly. We didn't try and track them down, but they're getting a power source from
somewhere. You're saying that's a generator for them, then?
No, that's not the generator, sir. That's the
the power from the generator.
No, the power for power. That box comes
from the utilities.
From the utilities somewhere. That there's a big power cable goes into the ground. It comes out somewhere and connects. I don't know where. But what's inside that box?
Is
all the RF electronic gear.
No, I understand
the stuff that.
That,
yeah.
I understand and, that and part of it on the pole, but they need a backup. So their backup, if their power goes down, they got to have a backup somewhere. So they got to have a generator or batteries or something to do that with, right?
Yes, sir. And I don't know where that is. I don't know that it has to be located at the base of the utility pole. It just has to be connected to that radio shack somehow. I can't give you more detail.
Dr. Raines, there are ways to provide backup power to utility pole mounts such as that, correct? You're aware that it's done?
Yes.
Okay, so...
But it's obviously not sitting there at the bottom of the pole. It's at some distance, and it's connected by a power cable.
They have to find somewhere to put power to it.
Absolutely.
That's another problem.
It's a problem for any base station. They all run on power one way or another.
All right.
This figure shows you more of what you can do with a utility pole. This is a much more elaborate setup. It's more elaborate because of the cantilevered arrangement on top, and quite obviously, the antennas on top are serving all the sectors of a base station, not just one. So this probably has an alpha, beta, and gamma sector, just like most base station that's serving wireless network in all three sectors in all directions. So you can do it. Changing subjects a little bit, the FCC is very concerned about human exposure to radio frequency fields. And they have a...
Keep going. I'm sorry.
Right. Okay. Let's go back to the previous slide, Dan. Thank you. They have a prescribed procedure for calculating what that exposure might be, and it's a conservative procedure. Rightfully so. You don't want to play games with human health. So they've issued a booklet. It's a well-known among RF engineers called OET Bulletin 65, or we just always just called OET 65, and it has examples on how to calculate the exposure and compare it with the standard that's been approved by the FCC. So I quickly went through that calculation for the proposed monopole. And in the center of that sphere is the antenna, and the it radiates a certain amount of power, and the power spreads out over the surface of the sphere. It becomes a power density. So the source radiates watts, and over the surface of the sphere, you end up with watts per square meter. And the further out you go, the less the power density is, the power spreads out and dissipates. So we ask the question, where, at what distance from the antenna is the FCC standard for RF exposure violated? And it turns out that at cellular frequencies, the threshold is as low as 4.7 watts per meter squared. That's their... a danger signal. And at a sphere that's small enough, inside the exposure will be higher, so we've labeled that hazardous, and outside it'll be non-hazard. And so we ask the question, what about this tower? What can we say about whether a hazard exists or not? So we made some assumptions. Let's stick with the first one. Thank you. Typically, these applications ask for permission to radiate as much as 10,000 watts per carrier, and that 10,000 watts is spread out over three different sectors. Now, at any given time, you can be exposed to two of them. So that's two-thirds of 10,000 watts, which is 6,666 watts. And if you work the... procedure in that OET 65 backwards, you end up with a very simple formula that the radius to the hazard non-hazard zone is equal to 34.9 times the square root of the number of the providers on the tower in feet. And so if we plug in the numbers, so for a single provider on that tower, the radius of that sphere, which defines whether there's a hazard or not, is 34.9 feet. And if you put two providers on, it turns out to be 49.4 feet, and for three providers, it's 60.4 feet. So this is a sphere around the antenna. Okay, now we can go to the next one. How far does this sphere extend? Well, remember, it's around the antenna, so it doesn't get down to the ground, but it goes, whoops, it goes out, and in fact, for three providers, it gets to the boundary of that property, and you may recall from some of the other exhibits, there's a bunch of trees there. And you can bet dollars to donuts that someone's going to be working on those trees or be in a cherry pit or something, poke their head into that hazardous zone. And that's just one reason you don't want to plunk one of these cellular towers into a developed and highly residential area.
Great. Thank you.
You're saying, excuse me.
Go ahead.
But you're saying it's the elevation, it's elevated?
Yes.
Okay. And nothing reached the ground?
Well, something reaches the ground, but it's not, sir.
All right, yeah.
And just for the record, this is the image from on the site map we're turning in, so we'll turn this in. I think that's all the. Is there anything else that you felt you needed to comment that we missed?
I think I've said everything I.
I have no further questions. Does the board have any further questions for Dr. Raines?
Are you saying that the proposed tower would not meet FCC regulations for RF emissions?
Let me think about that for just a moment. I can envision a situation where no, it would not, because as I said, up in the air, within 60.4 feet of that antenna, if someone's up there working in the trees or doing something up there, not necessarily on that property, but right next, they're going to poke their head into that sphere. And that's a practical matter that I think you could ponder even better than I. People do work around towers and facilities, and most of these towers are way out in the boondocks where nobody gets near them, and no one has a reason to get near them. But when you put them in a developed and occupied area, things happen.
How high up is that? I mean, what is the danger area from the ground to a 100-foot tower?
It's a sphere. It's a sphere around the antenna, and the antenna's up on, it's going to be 100 feet up, and there's a sphere that's as big as 60 feet in radius that's going to extend out. So, it's not going to be someone, it'll be someone working up in the air or something like that.
Would it be fair to characterize, you were just showing what the FCC standard is, the distances around, and that's what where the hazard areas and not hazard areas, more of an educational thing, correct?
Well, I certainly hope as a minimum it's educational. If it's a practical hazard, I think it's for this board to decide whether someone's going to be working up in a cherry picker or something. I'm not going to presume to tell you what's going to happen in that.
All right, thank you, Dr. Randall.
So wherever you move that, you're just talking about moving it down area farther over? You were talking about moving that down on a pole, a molly pole, or electric pole, either one? Still going to have the same effect on somebody else. It's going to affect somebody else's neighborhood, right?
No, sir, because remember, the radius of that sphere depended on the number of independent providers. If you only have one, it shrinks from 60 down to 34. Mm-hmm. So it's a much smaller sphere. Now, whether someone's going to poke their head into that smaller sphere versus a larger one, that's up to you to decide. But the pole, the utility pole is different in that regard. The sphere will be much smaller.
I'd just like to get back to the question I asked. Is it your position that what is being proposed would not violate FCC standards for RF emissions?
I have to answer yes, because the emissions on the ground, if someone's walking around on the ground, they're not in danger.
Are you aware if the FCC enforces those things when it comes to its antenna, to the antennas it approves?
Yes, they are quite capable of sending out a team to make measurements and issue fines and orders to modify and cease and desist. There was a famous case in the Front Range of Colorado 10 years ago or so where I was involved, and there was a cluster of communications towers They weren't cellular towers. They were FM and television broadcast towers. And they clearly violated the FCC standards on the ground. And they had perceptible effects. They weren't just academic interests. There were garages that were opening by themselves and apparently electric wheelchairs that went berserk and went.
But these weren't cell towers. These were.
They may have had cellular antennas on them, but they were primarily for television and FM radio broadcast.
The reason I'm asking specifically is there was the Telecommunications Act of 1996, which specifically directs that this board cannot consider environmental effects if the RF emissions are within the FCC guidelines. No. So that's why I was asking you.
Well,
if you
within that sphere, they're not. And, you know, it'd be my opinion if somehow someone gets into that sphere, the answer is no, they don't comply.
And you said that, and I just want to make sure I've got that right, that the sphere, if there were three providers, would radiate approximately 60.4 feet.
That's correct.
From the center of the sphere, the center of the antenna, in all directions.
Yes.
All right. I have no further questions.
Okay.
Okay. Any further questions?
Doctor.
Did you say take a break?
Everybody want to take a pause for a few moments? Okay.